people assume that those who are supposed to have this skill are the most articulate. It's not true. The quiet people in the room, the silent ones, are very powerful negotiators, right? Because, you know, silence by itself is a loud bang. Have you ever been somewhere you're talking and talking and talking and talking and the guy is just looking at you? And when you finish talking for 10 minutes, say, this is my price. And you talk and talk and talk and talk. I say, this is my price, sir. And the next time you talk and talk and talk, he says nothing. Absolutely nothing. Right. So listening is a skill that people need to acquire, you know, to be good negotiators. And it's not a skill that many people are ready to acquire, because culturally, a lot of us believe that, you know, you have to be the active talker to get things done when you have these conversations, which itself is a myth, right? It's actually the other way around.
Every big thing starts small. It's a natural law. Every big multinational corporation was once a small business. Welcome to the Small Starter Business Podcast, a unique podcast for practical tips and advice to help you start, grow, or turn around your business. Welcome to another episode of the Small Starter Business Podcast. I am your host, as usual, John Paul Iwoha. Today's episode is quite special because I'm reaching into our private members program, The Insiders, to share with you an interview, an interesting conversation I had with a gentleman. Now, this gentleman is an expert negotiator, and negotiating skills is one of those very important, valuable, and strategic skills that any entrepreneur should have. You're going to need negotiation skills when you're dealing with customers. You're going to need it when you're dealing with suppliers, when you're dealing with distributors. You're going to need it when you're dealing with employees. Either you're trying to hire an employee or you're trying to fire an employee. And most importantly, you're going to need negotiation skills when you're dealing with investors. So negotiation skills are a cornerstone of any skill set an entrepreneur would have. So it's very important that we're bringing somebody who is very experienced, more than 30 years experience in the legal practice and in negotiating all sorts of deals. He's negotiated multi-million dollar deals, and I can't wait for you to listen to the value bombs that Mr. Ayuli Jemide shared with us in this interview. If you're an insider, I'm sure you've already watched this and you may have participated in this session, but I just wanted the broad audience of our podcast to have a taste of what our members get, especially during our monthly mastermind sessions. So let me allow you to listen to this and then I'll talk to you afterwards.
Today we have a very interesting guest, a very distinguished guest. And before you hear from him, I think it's very befitting to, of course, do the introduction before we hear from our special guest. Mr. Ayuli Jemide is a highly regarded commercial lawyer, business negotiator, and lead partner at Nigeria's first non-courtroom practice law firm, Detail Solicitors. He is also the author of Listen Every How, the captivating new book on negotiation. He specializes in project finance, public-private partnerships, real estate, oil and gas, and corporate and commercial deals. He has been involved in several multi-million dollar deals, including Heineken BV's purchase of 5 breweries in Nigeria, the $80 million equity raise for Biloxi Industries, for those who know it's a biscuit production manufacturing company, and the $30 billion real estate investment trust for UPDC PLC, among others. He is a council member of the Nigerian Bar Association on the section on business law. He is a past president of the Nigerian Swiss Chamber of Commerce, and he's also a past non-executive director of the Central Bank of Nigeria, among other leadership roles. So, Mr. Ayuli Jemide, welcome to the Mastermind of the Insiders community and the Small Starter Business Podcast. Our members have really been looking forward to this because I told them I have a big fish. I got a big fish and it's coming in and we're going to keep it for ourselves, yeah, for about an hour. So thank you very much for doing us the honor.
Thank you. Thank you, John Paul. It's a pleasure to be here.
You're welcome.
And I look forward to this conversation.
Okay. So typically, we'll start with an icebreaker. And, you know, doing the research for your profile, it was getting longer than I planned. So it was very difficult to more or less trim it to size. You're a man of many parts. You've held several leadership positions. So I'm thinking, what is that thing what's one interesting thing about you that most people don't know?
There's one I'll tell. There are several, but I'll tell you one. Most people don't know that I struggled at the time with confrontation. When I first started running my business, I found it difficult to confront people. And it's interesting now that I'm writing a book on negotiation, which, you know, a bit of it is confrontation. You have to be firm at certain points. But, you know, I remember when I started my business, I couldn't scold my staff and look them in the eyes. True story. I mean, if I was scolding them, you would think I'm the one who committed the offense, because I'm moving things about on my table. I'm just, you know, and after that, I get all sap pangs, and, you know, so I had to deal with that. And I just dealt with it by speaking to myself and setting goals and targets for myself. So each time I needed to have a hard conversation with someone, I would say to myself, you have to look them in the eyes. And, you know, when I succeed in doing that, I then realized that your ability to do that is actually very powerful, because when you do that, you come out very sincere. And even when you're not scolding someone, even when you are praising someone, you should look them in the eyes, because it's a mark of sincerity that you really mean what you're saying. But, you know, some of my staff today, when I tell them this story, they'll say, that's a fable. It can't be you. But that's what I would say for now.
I think it's quite interesting that somebody who is an expert in business negotiations actually started from what you would call an insular position, right? So
yes.
I think the message clearly is that anybody can do this. If you put your mind to it, anybody can do this. So the most interesting part of our conversation today is that all the people in the audience are enterprise builders. There are different stages of building their business. And as you would imagine, most of them have to negotiate either with customers, employees, suppliers, investors, and all of that. So the first question I think would be, why is negotiation such an important skill? And why is it that so many people are not great at this seemingly important skill that I'll call a survival skill to get through life, to get through business? Apparently, you need to be good at negotiation. So why is it important, and then why are most people not really good at it?
Well, I mean, the first thing I'll tell you why it's important is that, you know, even where it's a non-commercial negotiation, there's always value, right? So even if you're negotiating with a family member, there's always some value involved. Talk less of when it's a commercial negotiation. So it's important because, you know, you can lose value and you can gain value, right? You know, and that for me is, you know, it could mean a lot, because that value could run into, you know, thousands or millions in any currency. So I think the second reason why it's important is we may not want to admit this, but anytime we are bullied, it erodes our self-esteem. And, you know, we console ourselves by saying, oh, well, you know, you win some, you lose some. Yeah, it's true. You win some, you lose some. Some you didn't have to lose if you were a bit more tactful or a bit more knowledgeable, or you played your cards right, right? So if we really admit to ourselves, we feel bad anytime we walk out of a place and say, wow, that guy just took me to the cleaners. I do. I don't know about you guys. I really feel bad anytime it happens. And then the third thing I would say why it's important is this is one skill that helps you constantly build your emotional intelligence quotient, because a lot of negotiation is emotional intelligence. So as you begin to apply things, you find out that your emotional intelligence increases. And then, John Paul, why do people not understand it as much as they should. I think the first thing is that it's one of those skills that people think is innate. So it's either you have it or you don't have it, which isn't true, as I have come to realize experientially, right? I think it's a skill that anybody can pick up. And the next thing is people assume that those who are supposed to have this skill are the most articulate. It's not true. The quiet people in the room, the silent ones, are very powerful negotiators, right? Because, you know, silence by itself is a loud bang. Have you ever been somewhere you're talking and talking and talking and talking and the guy is just looking at you? And when you finish talking for 10 minutes, say, this is my prize. And you talk and talk and talk and talk. I say, this is my prize, sir. And the next time you talk and talk and talk, he says nothing. Absolutely nothing. Right. So listening is a skill that people need to acquire, you know, to be good negotiators. And it's not a skill that many people are ready to acquire, because culturally, a lot of us believe that, you know, you have to be the active talker to get things done when you have these conversations, which itself is a myth, right? It's actually the other way around. And I think the last thing I would say about why people are not good at this, a lot of people are negotiating without a stake in the game. So when you will notice that when the owner of the business sends the manager to go and negotiate something, and the manager comes and says, sir, they said it was $1,000. I managed to get it for $999. You know, you've seen those situations, and the owner of the business says, what? Put the man on the phone, right? Because the owner of the business is the one thinking really about the bottom line. He's not a salary earner. So a lot of people find out that they become good negotiators when they transit from, salary earners to actually entrepreneurs whose bottom line depend on these conversations.
Interesting. I think that last point really got me. It looks like when you have a stake in the conversation, it breeds that negotiation nerve that you're supposed to have. And this brings me to the next question, which is, what does a person need to know or do before they even step into a negotiation? So we're talking about like the preliminary phase. What do you need to know or do before you even step into any negotiation with a customer, with an investor, with a supplier, whoever?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, John Paul, because from my experience, preparation is key to getting into this conversation. And that's where a lot of people miss out. And I spend a lot of time in my book talking about preparation, because that's where you know the lay of the land. If you don't understand the lay of the land, how do you deploy the right kind of strategy? You don't know whether your land is swampy, you don't know whether it's marshy, you don't know whether it's desert. You don't know what the people on the other side are waiting for you with. You have no idea. So people just go into these rooms, you know, and it's there they exchange cards and they're now trying to get to know people there and then. You know, it's very wrong. It's not right. First and foremost, if you know who this person is and you've done your research, it helps you even with that conversation that breaks the ice. Those first few minutes before you start discussing business, people like to know that you found out a little bit about them, particularly if there are things that are, that are complementary, right? I don't know if you people have heard about the Maslow's theory of needs and, you know, how esteem is, you know, high up there amongst the needs, right? So you know, it's usually better to start a conversation by saying, oh, sir, you know, I read your book, or I read about you, or you are this, you know, just make the man feel at home that you respect him, you know, you hold him in high esteem. It does break the ice. And then if you know a bit about him to the point where there's common ground, it helps. You will find out that immediately you're able to say, well, you went to St. Gregory's College or Harvard. Oh, you know, even if the common ground is not with you, even if you say, oh, my brother was at Harvard, you ask me, what year? Even if you conclude that they were not in Harvard at the same time, right? It's better that you have no common ground at all, right? Because common ground helps. But if you get good common ground, you know, and I've walked into places where I've met people who were in secondary school with me, even though I don't remember them, right? And, you know, the conversation and the tone just changes, right? But beyond that, you know, there's a lot more you can know. You can ask yourself sometimes, why is somebody selling? And the answer to that question may be treasure for you.
Interesting. This is interesting. Now, your conversation, this conversation has somehow segued into the very first part of your book that got my attention. In fact, I started reading this book on a flight to Kano, and it looks like you opened with more or less a big bang, because that whole part about value, what value is, it was a very different perspective from what I'm used to. The whole thing about intrinsic value and all of that. So for the sake of our members of our community who haven't read the book, I think I'm just holding myself back from sharing, but I want them to hear from you directly. Why is value important in any negotiation of any type?
Well, so because you're going into a negotiation to take value from somebody or to add value to somebody, you know, value is constantly, you know, the thing that you're moving around, how much value someone gets or how much takes from you. So over the years, I've come to realize that there are value mindsets, you know, that play out. And like I said in the book, there are three of them, right? So the intrinsic value is people who just come into a transaction just on a plain vanilla basis, right? So a guy wants to buy a piece of property and you ask him, oh, you know, why do you want to buy this? He says, well, I just need a roof over my head. Or someone goes to a hotel that has a sea view and asks the person, give me a room. Say, sea view room. And he says, just give me a room. I just need a nice room to sleep. I'm tired. You know, whereas another person comes there and says, no, I need the sea view room, right? And you find out that the person who wants the sea view room is willing to pay more than the other person who comes in just for the intrinsic value of that hotel room is simply, you know, nice white sheets, the air conditioner is working, don't even open the windows, right? So you have intrinsic value, then you have tangential value. So the person who went to the hotel room and says, I want a sea view, you know, is interested in a nice room, but wants that tangential value, he picks this hotel because there's a sea view room, you know, and, you know, things that, well, you know, when I sit there and look at the boats go by, you know, I have a good feeling about it, right? And is willing to pay more for it and actually picks that hotel because it has a sea view, right? So these are two types of value, but there's a third one, which is trickier and more dangerous. And you will see why in a minute. And that's the emotional value. And once people get emotive and emotions get into something, you know that pricing begins to get irrational. So, you know, if someone is selling a piece of jewelry, you know, that the mother had, you know, but it was passed on from the grandmother, and you know, and it was passed on from the great grandmother, you know, and that piece of jewelry has heritage, but for some reason, you know, he or she needs to sell it, right? You'll find out that, you know, the pricing, when they say, well, this is market price, and no, but my, you know, this jewelry, you know, my great grandmother passed it on, and she he or she wants to attach a higher price because of the emotional value, right? Whereas the person who is buying says, well, you know, I don't know your grandmother, just see this piece of jewelry, right? So when you're able to identify people who come in with emotional value, particularly if you are a seller and you find a buyer who is emotional, right, about a purchase, you know, the price point shoots up instantly. They will pay more.
So what you're saying, this is very interesting. What it means is that I can have one particular item, but the value can be three different things to three different people. One person just sees it as, for example, like you said, the room. This is just a room, right? Yeah. The other person says, I want a room, but the aesthetics matter to me, the sea view. And then somebody is like, this is where my husband proposed to me, so it has to be that room.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, you know, I want room, so. Say, mom, it's fully booked. Say, no, I want that. I say, why do you want that? I say, no, my husband proposed to me there. So I came back. It's like coming back to this place to relive the memories. You know, and if you're a wise salesman, you say, okay, but that room is fully taken. Let me see what I can do. And then if that room will go for $300 per night, usually you can come back and say, well, you know, ma'am, I've managed to move the occupant to another room, but, you know, it's $600. The woman will say, I'll take it.
Interesting. Okay. So value.
I'll take it.
So for our members, this has significant consequences for pricing. So there is no one thing as market price. It all depends on the person you're selling to. Okay, that brings us to a point where I think another point that caught me in the book was the chess analogy. I can't think of any other game that, you know, exemplifies negotiation like chess. And then you mentioned that, okay, every chess piece is the same, you know, the king, the queen and all that. But then you made particular notes of the pawns, who are the foot soldiers that stand in front of more or less the officers, right? And you said that using your pawns can be a very, you have to be very strategic about it, because the pawns may seem like the expendable ones, but they have significant power if you know how to use them. Yeah, so I want you to talk about, in the context of that analogy, how do you cleverly use pawns in a negotiation, and what are those pawns? Because I like how you talked about them in the book.
Yeah, excellent. So, I mean, like you rightly said, you know, pawns in a chess game are perhaps the most malleable of the pieces. They are both a defense and an attack. Sometimes you push a pawn forward just to block someone for a particular move, right? And sometimes you push a pawn forward to push somebody, to make someone make a move so that there will be an opening. Right. And, you know, that's the way it actually works in negotiation. But you have to be constantly thinking, where are my pawns? And, you know, those pawns will differ from one negotiation to the other. And there could be a 1,000 pawns out there, depending on, you know, your own scenario. But, you know, I'll just mention one or two. I mean, and one of them that's really, really powerful, most people should learn how to use, is time. It's time. Oh, I'm always so happy when I meet someone on the other side who is in a hurry. They have deadlines. And if you don't close this by so-and-so time, you know, ABC is going to happen. And then I check my own situation. And I say, oh, well, you know, I'm not in a hurry. So I'm now ready to play the patient game. You know, there's a proverb that says that to catch a cricket, you have to be patient. You know, so that's one. And time, for example, can either be a pawn or a threat. And sometimes whilst you're identifying pawns, you're also identifying threats, because those a threat to me is a pawn in the other person's hand. So if I know that I'm in a hurry, it's a threat to me. Now, if that person never knows that I'm in a hurry, then he doesn't see it as a pawn. So I have to conceal my threats and identify my pawns constantly. You know, another pawn is, again, back to the value mindsets that we talked about. You know, and, you know, we talked about the emotional value. That in itself is a pawn. You've identified, oh, well, man, this person really needs this place. There's emotions attached to this, right? And once you identify that, you know, it's at that time people will start telling you things like, well, you know, madam, you have to hurry. There are three other people interested in this property, you know, and all kinds of things and those gimmicks. And then talking about pawns, you know, we are also dealing with human beings. Negotiation is with human beings, right? And every human being comes with a certain amount of pride and prejudice, right? And, you know, depends on how you locate people and what prism you use to view them. Those can be very powerful pawns. I've seen people sell things at rock bottom price to certain people and supposedly lose money out of pride and prejudice. To just give you a simple example. So if you know that someone is the kind of person who wants to do everything that all his peers are doing, all you need to say to him is, that your friend just bought a house in Banana. He said, really? Please. you know, because you've identified that he's that kind of person, right? Who flows, you know, based on, you know, that sentiment. And people take advantage of it. You know, people buy cars they don't need. And they buy it at, you know, ridiculous prices. You know, it's pride and prejudice. So it plays out in different ways. And they're just different pawns all out there. You just have to constantly identify them.
Okay. Thank you. So what this means is I just identified an area where I may have been played several times. So you're going to check out a piece of property and they ask you to bring Madame along. They ask you to bring the wife along. Sometimes they ask you to bring the kids. And those are the emotional levers. Because if your wife likes it and the kids like it, you're in trouble.
Jean-Paul, if I'm selling property to you, when you walk in, as you are talking to me, I'm not looking at you. My eyes will be on your wife to know her reaction. I want to see whether there's a glint in her eyes, you know, whether she's touching the wall. You know, if the kitchen has a marble counter, I want to see whether she runs her hands over the marble counter. You know how people run their hands over a marble counter as if they want to eat the counter. Right? You know? Oh, this is marble, you know. So you're watching out for all that. And by the time you're leaving, you know, I will know whether your wife is in love with the place. And I'm watching out for the nuances between you and your wife. Remember that when you come into a negotiation, it's not necessarily the person who is doing the talking that's the boss. Sometimes the person at the head of the table is not even the boss. It's some quiet person there. But you keep watching this person, and each time he talks, he would look at that person for confirmation. Have I said the right thing? You understand? And when he's going to respond to you, he will look at that person, permission to speak. You understand? And maybe sometimes that person will give him a signal and say, keep quiet, say nothing. Right? So if I realize that, you know, between you and your wife, she's the boss, which is many times, even though we don't admit it, you know, I will want to take her to the kitchen and, you know, the places that I know, you know, a woman will fall in love with. If I know, you know, if I get the sense that she likes plants, I will say, you know, you have a huge garden, you have this, right? I'm selling to her, even though I know you're the one who will pay.
Interesting. Interesting tips. So these guys are everywhere. These guys who have been having us for a long time, they're everywhere. So I think at this point, it will be nice to hear from you more or less like a real-world example, the recollection of a tough negotiation you had. You know, how did you come through? What did you learn? You know, if there's something our members here can get from that, a real-life battle you actually faced.
Yeah. So I had a situation once where I had a client who bought a piece of property, you know, in a very highbrow part of Lagos. I wasn't part of that transaction when he bought the property. He became my client after that. And then he received notice that he had encroached somebody else's property. So I asked him, I said, you know, were you the one who fenced the property? He said, no, he bought it fenced. So I said, did you measure it against the... He said, no, he didn't do all that. He just paid. So we did the measurements and found out that indeed he was sitting on property that was larger than what it should have been on his title documents, right? So I said to him, I said, indeed, you may have encroached your neighbor. You know, I said, but wait a minute, let's find out when this fence was built. So I actually got, got a lab to come, you know, crack the wall, take samples, and do me a report. And it turns out that the fence was built many, many years ago. And of course, we have proof for when he purchased, right? So I went into that negotiation with a relevant fact that my client didn't mean to encroach. Didn't encroach. Technically didn't encroach because there was no intention to do so. You know, he just bought a piece of property that was already fenced, right? And, you know, everything in life has philosophies. And once you can put a philosophy on the table, it helps the conversation. So I said to the guy, I said, you know what? This is a victim's meeting. And he said, what do you mean by victim's meeting? I said, well, you know, your property got encroached by someone who fenced this land many, many years ago. And my client bought it. So you're both victims. So let's have the victim's conversation and see how we come out of it. And what I was just trying to do was just to lay a foundation for, you know, for a conversation that's more productive, for a conversation that doesn't label my client as a thief and a, you know, criminal who fails beyond, you know. And you know, I noticed that as soon as I said that, and I said to them, look, I've done a lab report. Here it is. Go and confirm it yourself. Confirm first and foremost that I did this report at so-and-so place. Take samples and go to another lab and get a confirmation. And when you put people on the spot like that and say, go and confirm it yourself, they know that, you know, you are being transparent, right? And then whilst we were talking, I then asked the guy, but where have you been? How come you've had this land for so long? How come you've just realized that you have a problem? He said, well, we just want to build now. And, you know, we really need to build. We're in a hurry because, you know, we have off-takers for this place. And I said, you should have told me that. You should have told me that. So you don't have time on your hands. So he says, so when is our next meeting? I said, well, you know, I'm not available for the next 2 weeks. He said, no, you can't. I said, Anyway, I stringed and dragged him along, postponed meetings and all that. By the time we finally met, you know, he had now come with a more senior person in the company, then I knew that this thing was serious, right? And, you know, they were more willing to accept my proposition. So my client eventually paid for that portion of the land, but at 30% of the going rate for property in that area at that point in time, right? Because it's what it is. And we did some adjustments to the boundaries and all that. But, you know, so what did I learn? You know, first thing, again, time was a pawn. Time was a pawn here. You understand? And then getting your facts right. You know, if you are dealing with normal human beings, right, principles always work. So that principle of, look, he was not the one who fenced the land, right? It kind of disarmed them, right? Because they were coming with this big stick to think, okay, we're going to whip you and all that. So, yeah.
Interesting battle story there. Interesting battle story. So, more or less, to wrap up this segment, and I just want to mention to the insiders who are here, if you have any questions for Mr. Ayuli, just use the chat feature. As I see the questions come up, I'm going to just weave them into our conversation. At this point, I want to ask one interesting question about mistakes. Now, I've been in several different situations where I've come out and telling myself I could have got more, or I yielded too much and things like that. So, but I want to know, in your 30 years plus of experience, what do you think is one common mistake that people make when they are in a negotiation?
I would like to demonstrate this mistake.
Wow. Okay.
What does that mean to you?
What? See no evil, hear no evil. What?
They go in blindfolded.
Okay.
They go in blindfolded. Many people go into these conversations with their eyes open, but they are blindfolded because they have no information whatsoever, right? So, and once you don't have information, right, you are either haggling or bargaining. And there's a difference between haggling, bargaining, and negotiating. Haggling is potluck. It's what you do on the street when the guy on the street wants to sell you a used book. And he says, it's $1,000. I say, no, 500. No, pay 600. I say, no, 550. Right? You don't know what the cost of the book. You're just, and even that 500, you may have bought the book at three times the cost. Because you don't even know what the price of that book is, but it just sounds good to you, right? So that's haggling. Now, bargaining is, you know, when you just use certain stereotypical chips. Okay, well, if I buy 1,000 pieces, how much discount do I get? That's bargaining, right? But negotiating, you know, requires a bit more skill. And the real skill you require in negotiating is information gathering and how to synthesize, distill, and use that information. You actually place them on the table and say, well, this one is a threat to me. This is a pawn. How do I protect myself from threats? And how do I use my pawns? Right. So really, people tell you cash is king, John Paul. I say, yes, I agree that cash is king, but knowledge is queen.
Knowledge is queen. I guess when they come together and get married, all you get then is success, I believe.
Yeah.
That's essentially knowledge what happens.
Yeah.
Interesting. Thank you very much. That last part there had solid nuggets. There's a big difference between haggling, bargaining, and negotiating. So I guess where the skill is, in fact, the best way I can think of this is a roadside mechanic and a mechanical engineer. So, yeah. Right, that's how I want to say. One is crude, one is going by the seat of his pants. The other one is much more measured and following some scientific approach. Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
That's scientific, yes.
Okay. Okay. Thank you very much for answering all our questions. And I'm still expecting any questions from the community. Just use the chat feature in there. I'm going into an interesting segment now, which is more or less to know a bit more about you. And of course, I understand you're a commercial lawyer, you're a negotiator. But if in some alternate universe, you were not a lawyer, what else would you have been?
John Paul, that's a really tough question. And it's a tough question because I didn't want to be a lawyer in the first place. So that's a tough question. And then it's also a tough question because if I showed you my secondary school testimonial. I don't know if they still do testimonials these days, but you know, in those days when you left school, they have something they call the testimonial, which is signed by your principal and, you know, your character and things that your principal noticed about you. And my principal's comments in my testimonial was, Ayuli is a versatile young man. Ayuli is a keen sportsman and a versatile young man. You know, and, you know, this is secondary school. I was leaving secondary school at the age of, what age do you leave secondary school?
15, 16.
Okay. So I remember thinking to myself, what's the meaning of versatile? Right? And I just, you know, went to check again. But over time, I've seen that versatility play out in my life, right? I can do many things. I could have been a builder, interior decorator, photographer, you know, tour guide, you know, many things. Professor in a university is something I would have done very well. So it's difficult to tell you what I would have been, but I can tell you many other things, but not one. And I don't believe that. I also believe that, you know, people have different trajectories in life. Some people are designed to do certain things for a certain amount of time and transit and do other things for a certain amount of time and transit and do other things. There are some people who do certain things for 10 years. The next 10 years, they do something totally different and they do it well. The next 10 years, they do something totally different and they do it well. And there's nothing wrong with that. There are people who do the same thing for 50 years and they do it well for the 50 years. And there's nothing wrong with that. But I think I belong to the second, the first category. I would like to do, you know, different things at different times.
Okay. So I came across this term a couple of years back for your kind of person. It's called a multi-potentialite. And I'm like, wow. Okay.
I've never heard this before.
A multi-potentialite is a person who could have reached the zenith of their career in any area where they are very keen. So I think that's quite an interesting point. Before I ask you the second question, a question has come in here from Alpha. Alpha Barry is one of our members. He's from Senegal, but he's based in Canada. And this is his question. He says, Donald Trump is considered a keen negotiator. How do you perceive his style and how to negotiate with his type of negotiation style?
Okay. I mean, Trump is also perceived as an unreasonable person. And also perceived as someone who is brash, says it as it is, no matter how it sounds, and just, you know, sticks to it, right? And there's something in my book called The Paradox of Unreasonableness, where I say that a lot of unreasonable people end up getting their way because the rest of us want to be reasonable. So someone just comes and he says, you know, this is it. And you say, well, it can't be like that. And you are enunciating principles and reasons why it can't be like that. And you say, no, that's it. And you say, but you know, you're not listening. You say, no, I'm not listening. That's it. And if you go beyond that, he or she would throw a tantrum. You understand? And depending on how much you want the deal, you start begging them, no, okay, sit down, you know, let's talk. Right. I would classify Trump as that kind of negotiator who leverages on that, you know, unreasonableness and wants to bully people. So the question then is, what are your stakes? What is your value mindset? And how do you approach people like that? Honestly, if you have options, avoid people like that. It's a lot of times it doesn't end well. So, you know, I've walked out of places where I just said, well, you know what, you know, we can buy the same thing down the road. Why do we have to have a hard conversation about it, right? But if you can't buy it down the road, then, you know, you're stuck with this, or you have a client who has an emotional value and says, no, it's this thing or not, you know, then you have to find your way around it. And it's then you start asking yourself, okay, do I have time on my hands? How many other sellers are there? It's then you start trying to shuffle your pawns to see how you can get this person not to be reasonable, because when people come into that conversation, you know, they are probably just innately unreasonable, you know, or that's their style, right? But you can get people to change their mind, not because of what you say, even though what you say will influence how they change their mind, but you get them to change their mind because they think that they change their minds. So you have to find something that you constantly sleep in that would then make him say he has changed his mind or he has shifted his position. But he's the one who shifted his position. Even you gently put some things on the table that will help him. And you know, there's no set science to this. Each of these transactions will be situational.
Okay. Thank you very much for that. This brings me to the second question I have for you, which is, what is a perspective on life or business that you have that most people may not agree with?
Okay, so there will be several, but I'll just give you one. You know, a lot of people like to have pity parties concerning their past or their pedigree or something that happened, or some disability, or some incapability. You know, I've bumped into people who say, well, you know, I'm like this because I grew up in a broken home. You know, I'm like this because, you know, I lost my dad early. You know, and things happen, right? But, you know, when I say this, people don't agree with me very often, right? When I say, you know what, get over it and move on. Right? And I say that because I say, look, if you look around you, you would always, each and every one of us has one disability or the other. Even the people who came from the richest homes have a disability because they are now tagged as rich, spoiled kids. And when they walk into places, people expect them to pay double. That's a disability, you know, and they are also now trying to prove themselves that, look, you know, I'm working hard. It's not my father's money. That's a disability. You know, it could be just as bad as the other person who came from a not so rich home. Right. So, you know, and I've told you my story of, you know, and I'll tell you one thing quickly, right, which is related to what I told you earlier on, that I couldn't look people in the eyes when I was scolding them. Similarly, when I went for conferences, I couldn't talk to people unless they spoke to me. And I convinced myself that I was a quiet person. That's why. I was an introvert. And when I hear these things, you know, some of the lawyers in my firm say, you know, I'm an introvert. I say, you know, just keep your mouth shut. You like to label yourself an introvert because it's a comfortable place to be. Once you've labeled yourself an introvert, then you know you don't need to task yourself to go and talk to people or go out there and market your business, right? Yeah. So I started giving myself assignments. I will go to a conference, and I would say, Ayuli, you are carrying 30 cards in your pocket. You must give them all out before you leave here. And you know, you can't just go to somebody and put a card in his pocket. You must make a conversation that will lead to you saying, here's my business card, right? Which means you're going to have to make short conversations with 30 people. And when I started doing it, if I set the 30 mark, and sometimes I do 10, you know, I then say to myself, wow, this is not so difficult, right? So I can say this to people because, you know, I'm a product of, you know, that mindset that says, you know what, you know, you have to deal with these disabilities and move on.
Okay. So, Ayuli, thank you very much for that. In fact, in summary, what it means is that no matter how reasonable your so-called deficiencies may be, they're actually nothing, you know, they don't really hold you back. I want to take you through a rapid question session. We're getting questions coming in here from our members. And I want you to devote just 1 minute each to each question. The first is, somebody has just gone into a negotiation with a hotel group and is negotiating for cheap rates for some of their under-occupied rooms. The first meeting went well, right? So I guess the question would be, what do you really do when the first meeting goes well? And then you want it to, you want to follow it through to the closing. You know, what do you do when something is going well so that you don't get hit by a surprise out of nowhere? Now, I don't know how you want to go, but I'll just give you the three questions and then you handle everything together. The
let me take them one by one.
Okay, good, good.
Let me take them one by one so my memory doesn't fail me. Okay. And by the way, all our memories fail us from time to time. We don't want to admit it. Yeah, I think when you have a first meeting that goes well, for as long as it's not a situation where if you show that you are in a hurry, someone will take advantage of you, I will close while the momentum is high. So in that situation, if that first meeting went well, you know, and even if you haven't agreed on a price or you've agreed on a price, I'll send a deposit. I'll send a letter. I'll send a contract. I'll do something to close it while that momentum is high, because you don't know who else is looking at that hotel and probably can pay more and take more rooms and has better bargaining power than you.
So the second question is from Gwandu in Botswana. And he's talking about this common thing about people who tell you that they want a win-win outcome in a negotiation. That is it not possible that that is a ruse for you to bring down your guard so that they can take advantage of you? Or is it really true that win-win can be like the standard in most negotiations we walk into?
Win-win can be the standard, and win-win is my advice, right? And if you ask me to define negotiation, I always define it as you giving your best to someone from whom you want the best.
Okay.
So win-win is my preference. I prefer people to come into negotiations thinking of people as counterparties as opposed to adversaries. And even when you are in an arm's length negotiation where, you know, you're going to purchase something and you may never see the person again, you know, I still think that, you know, you should try and aim for a win-win, because reputationally, your reputation stays with you for the rest of your life, you know, and you don't know where you meet that person again and what kind of doors this person will open, you know, and all that.
Okay. Thank you very much. The third and final question is, how do you, this is coming from Gilbert, he's one of our members in Ghana. He's asking, how do you walk out of a negotiation when you've already invested so much? You know, you're getting all these obstacles, you've been surmounting them, but it looks like the obstacles never stop coming. How do you just walk out of that kind of negotiation?
It's very interesting. And I said something in my book about the one leg in, which in itself is another poem, right? And the one leg in is these kinds of situations, and people do it on purpose, right? You know, people do it on purpose. People can ask you to make, you know, 20 presentations on your product, and they've not even discussed the price, but they keep asking questions. Okay, you've spoken to me. Let me call my commercial manager. They call another meeting. The commercial manager comes in. Then you speak to the commercial manager. I say, oh, okay, fine. Come another day, the technical manager will join. You know, they keep it there, and they say, okay, can you find us this? Can you explain this? And you've had 20 meetings, right? And you're now feeling you spend so much time, you need to close. They knew what they were doing. They were just trying to make sure that you get one leg in. And then once you get one leg into the room, you then feel you spend so much time, you need to close. And once you are in that position, John Paul, it's imminent that they're going to shave your head on the price. Right? It's imminent.
Wow. My goodness. This is warfare.
It's
real
imminent.
Warfare.
Yes. So, okay. So the first thing is not to get you, try and not get into that place. But it's a difficult one because you also want to sell. You understand? You know? So it's catch 22. right? Okay. But to answer the question, if you finally find yourself there and you say, you know, I need to work out, how do I work out? The answer is simple. Cut your losses. Cut your losses. The only way to work out is just to work out. So there are times you just have to cut your losses and say, you know what, this is a dead end.
Wow. Oh, my goodness. I know this conversation can go on, but you're a very busy man. And for those of us who don't know who this man is, you guys don't understand how much value we've gotten from this conversation. But what is most important is this book. Now, when he sent it to me, I'm like, okay, another book. But then it was an easy read. I finished it in one day, and it is amazing. I've only read two major books on negotiation. But thanks to you, I can't remember the name of the other one, because this is now my own go-to book. It's very relatable. It's very relatable. As an African, I could understand many of the stories and analogies you used in there. So I think the next question would be for people who are interested in getting this book. Now, for our members who are here, I'm going to make a bulk order that I'm both physical copy and e-books that I'm going to distribute to our members free of charge. All you have to pay for is the delivery. I'm already going to take care of our members. But for people who are listening to this on the podcast, for example, who want to have a taste of what you have to offer in this book, where can they find it?
Okay, several outlets. Amazon. Amazon has the paperback and the ebook version. You can also go to Okada Books. I think Okada Books has the ebook version. You can go to Roving Heights. Roving Heights, at least within Nigeria, Roving Heights will deliver to you. And you can go online and pay for it. They will deliver to you. And then in another few days, I think maybe a day or two, Latana Books will come on stream. And you can also buy online. They will deliver to you, you know, within Nigeria. So that's it. But outside Nigeria, I think Amazon may be your best bet. I'm not sure if Roving Heights does outside Nigeria, but you can check.
Wow. Thank you. Thank you very, very much. Thank you very much for doing us the honors. I have learned a lot from this conversation. Thank God it's recorded. So our members can always reference this these materials. Now that you're coming out of law practice into speaking,
I guess one of your members in Ghana... Mm-hmm. John Paul, one of your members in Ghana is asking me what about Ghana. So let him know that if he finds me at an outlet in Ghana, I'll be happy to work with people in Ghana as well to put the book.
That's a business deal right there. That's a business deal right there. So Gilbert, you heard Ayuli. You can make this happen for people in Ghana. I think we have two members in Ghana who are here, Maxwell and Gilbert. But then we can definitely take this offline. So Ayuli, I really want to thank you for making yourself available for showing up on this mastermind. And unfortunately, I can't start putting everybody on their mics to speak, right? So that it doesn't affect the quality of the podcast. But I hope all of us got value from this conversation. And we really want to say a very big thank you for being with us.
My pleasure, John Paul. Speak soon.
Yes, it was quite interesting. Listening to this again, I just realized just how valuable some of the tips and the wisdom Mr. Ayuli shared with us in here. So today's episode is brought to us by our partners, Quezza. Quezza is an e-commerce platform for entrepreneurs who are trying to access markets within and outside their own countries on the African continent. Merchants on Quezza have been able to find and deliver to customers in America, in Canada, and the UK. So if you have a small business and you're trying to access new markets, new interesting markets within or outside the African continent, then you really need to check out Quezza. Search for Quezza on the App Store. Whether you're using an Apple device or an Android device, search for Quezza, Kuueza. Quezza. Download the app and start using it to do interesting things for your business. So at this point, there are four interesting things I need us to keep in mind. The very first is to join the Insiders program. The interview you just listened to is an exclusive content material from the Insiders members area. I just wanted to share this because I think its negotiation skills are a very important skill that I didn't want our brother members to miss out of this. So if you want to become an insider, or you want to learn more about what we do in the insiders, check us out at smallstarter.com/insiders. The second thing I need you to consider is if you've been listening to this episode, to the episodes on the Small Starter Business Podcast, you want to give us a pat on the back. There are two ways you can do it. The first one is to tell your friends about this. Anybody who is trying to start a business or grow a business is going to get a lot of value from the content we share on the weekly podcast. And then the second thing you can do is to leave us a 5-star review on the podcast platforms. What this does is it tells the algorithm that we are a podcast that people should listen to. So it helps us with the rankings on the algorithm. And it's also a nice thing to have that we have people who are listening to us who appreciate the work that we do and deem it fit enough to give us a 5-star review. So don't forget, the insiders are members of our exclusive community. And if you want to become one of us, don't forget to check us out at smallstarter.com/insiders. Until the very next episode, stay safe, stay positive. Whatever it is you're working on is going to be hard right now. But as you keep at it, things are going to improve and get better. Talk to you in the very next episode. Cheers.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Small Starter Business Podcast. To take our free business courses or join one of our signature programs for special entrepreneurs like you, head over to smallstarter.com to join our private community. See you inside.